Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernackle. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kissel.
And today we have the first of our top 10 Mormon history books with Dr. Ben Park. So maybe to start talking about that, Brian, how many Mormon books, like Mormon studies, Mormon history books, do you think you could name off, like if you were in a bookstore, you could say, oh, that's important. Oh, that one's important. Mm. Oh, you need to read that one. What would be your guess on how many you would identify as important works of Mormon history?
Well, as far as identifying them, I think I could do a pretty good job. Sadly, I think I haven't read all of those, so I'm kind of just going off of what I've heard, like historians and heard other people I trust who were pointing them out. But like I mean, there's a bunch of like you can go. Like whenever I'm at Deseret Book, I try to play the game. What's a good a good one? You know, so I'm looking, and I think most things from like Greg Coford books are pretty good. I like I would point to things like from Richard Bushman and Todd Compton and Terrell Gibbons. So it's more looking at individuals who I've listened to and who I really like their perspectives. But as far as like even going further back, like Leonard Arrington, but then you start getting, I'm not quite sure. So I could probably think of some.
Yeah. But I would guess that you just saying, oh yeah, that's an important book. I would bet you would be over 50 books easily.
Oh, totally.
Maybe 100 books where you'd say, oh yeah, that's a really important book as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. As far as just like pointing out books that I've heard really good things about and things that I would kind of think are valuable sources. Yeah. More than 100.
Yeah. And so it's overwhelming because you listen to all these podcasts, you read these blog posts, you read book reviews, you talk with other people and they say, oh, I just read this book and it was wonderful or it was mind blowing or whatever. And you start to rack up all these books, at least like on your to read list, and you're never going to get to them because there's so many. And so that's why I contacted Ben, because that's kind of what he does is this. He puts together these lists of books, and we narrowed it down to 10. And the first one is the book that, if you only want to read one book about Mormon history, read Matthew Bowman's The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith, because that one kind of covers everything. And if you're not a reader, this is the one book that you can go to, and that's what we talk about today. And the first part of the interview, there's this short little lecture that Ben gives on the development of the new Mormon history and how the discipline of Mormon history and the societies of the Mormon history movement, kind of like Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon History, Mormon History Association. He talks about how those were founded and what key figures were. But if you just want to hear about the book, you can fast forward 10 or 15 minutes, and I'll come in right when that lecture starts and let you know at this point, if you want to fast forward, you can get right to the book, blah, blah, blah. So that's what's coming. I think it's a fascinating interview, and I look forward to all the other books we're going to talk about.
Very good. So again, this list is the top 10 influential books or the top 10 history books that people should look into, or what's the list again?
Okay, that's a good point. So no, it's not the most influential, because that would be like these ones that kind of shook the ground, like Von Brody, Juanita Brooks, the early ones, and really a few others, maybe Mike Quinn's books. But these are more like the works that are relatively recent. I think they're all published within the last 15 years. And so they're relatively recent works, and they're working, they're standing on the shoulders of the most influential ones. Some of them are very incredibly influential, like Rough Stone Rolling has been for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
But they're, if you're new to Mormon history and you want to understand the Mormon story, these are the books that you want to read. And they're actually, Ben has a funny comment in there, they're actually relatively short compared to some. I mean, Rough Stone Rolling is an outlier where it's how long is that thing? It's longer than the Book of Mormon. I remember that much. but it's a pretty long, detailed book. The rest of them are like, some of them are less than 200 pages, the main body, and some of them are longer, but most of them are 200 to 300 pages, something like that. And everyone that I've talked to about this list of books that I consider, you know, well-read, they're like, that's a great list to work from. It's, you know, I don't know what else I would pick if I had to limit it to 10 books.
Yeah.
And so it's like the lowest energy barrier to getting into the Mormon history scene and understanding the Mormon story, as I call it.
Very good.
So we'll jump right into the interview then. To start our podcast series on top 10 books in Mormon history / Mormon studies with Ben Park, this is the inaugural episode, and the first book that we're going to talk about is Matt Bowman's The Mormon People, the Making of American Faith. And before we get into that, I want Ben to tell us a little bit about himself, what he's been doing, why he has this great interest in thinking about the different books that come out talking about Mormon history or Mormon studies in general. And then we'll get into Matt Bowman's book, The Mormon People. So, Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and why this is such a great interest for you?
Sure, Brian. I'm glad to be on here with you. My name's Benjamin Park. I was raised in New Mexico. I did my bachelor's degree at Brigham Young University in English and History. I did master's degrees first at Edinburgh in historical theology and then at the University of Cambridge in political thought and intellectual history, where I then stayed on to do my PhD in history. My primary research field is early American political, cultural, religious, and intellectual history. I have a book manuscript that looks at the cultural practice of nationalism in the early republic, and I'm now a research fellow at the Kinder Forum on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri, where I'll also teach in the history faculty. But none of that is probably what makes me interested in this particular podcast, which is Mormon history and which has always been my my mistress in the academic world, because even though I focus on non-Mormon history, my main academic field, I've always held an interest in Mormon history. That was my intro into the historical craft, because I wanted to research my own religious background, and then that quickly led me to religious history and then American history in general. I've presented at the Mormon History Association a number of times. I've published in Journal Mormon History 4 times, Dialogue 3 or 4 times, John Whitmer Historical Journal a few times, and I currently serve as the associate editor for the Mormon Studies Review, a journal that's based at the Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship at Brigham Young University that seeks to trace the various developments of Mormon studies in the broad number of fields that fit underneath that umbrella. I also blog at a number of places, but one of the places I blog is Juvenile Instructor, which is a group blog focused on the academic study of Mormon history, where every few years or so, I write what I write as my, what I call my Mormon history comps list, which is in a theoretical world where a person has a reading field when, in Mormon history. What books would you have to read to get that check mark off? And I list 25 books. And I guess that's what led to Brian inviting me to come on this podcast, because I often have a keen interest on where the field of Mormon history is going, what it's going to do next, what its interests are, where its blind spots are, and things like that. Is that a decent enough background on me and my Mormon history background, Brian?
Perfect. Now we know who you are, where you're coming from. And I've seen a lot of book lists around. I've seen some on By Common Consent. I've seen some on, all around the different blogs. And you've done it pretty consistently, so I thought, here's a guy that we can talk about. We can get a list ironed out. And the problem with all these book lists is that if you look at even just one, I mean, yours is the 25 book list. That's a lot of books for someone that's not that isn't a anything more than a hobbyist.
Absolutely,
it's a lot to read, and so I liked that we were able to whittle it down to 10. And within that list of 10, most of them are fairly short. If you're looking at just the text and you ignore the notes like a lot of non-historians, non-scholars do, including myself, for the most part, they're, I don't know, 200 to 350 pages each.
So I would argue some of the best books in Mormon history are between 150 and 200 pages. That I think I have a theory that every 800 page book is a 400 page book in need of an editor, and every 400 page book is a 200 page book in need of an editor.
That's probably right. And you know, as we go along in our discussion on all these different books, we'll talk about. Well, in your list, you have a bias for books that have been published recently. So No Man Knows My History didn't make the cut.
Right. And explain my bias, because I don't think that, well, part of me thinks that the field grows and develops and it gets better. Right. So I do think that a lot of the books today are building on the shoulders of previous books. So while I don't assign Fawn Brody, I mostly feel comfortable just doing Bushman, because Bushman, I think, follows a lot of the same groundwork as Brody. He's updating a lot of the work of Brody. So in a way, we're getting Brody just packaged in Bushman's analysis. And we'll get more into that dynamics when we actually talk about Rough Stone Rolling. But yeah, I think that the field progresses, that it develops. And so the better work that's around now is building on the shoulders of the past. And I also feel that I'm, as a historian in the historical field now, you have to acknowledge that historical works are built in a certain environment. And so those of us who are living today have certain interests, certain assumptions, certain driving focuses. And these books that are written during our generation are written toward those focuses and assumptions and interests. And so, therefore, I think the books that are written in the last decade or two are most pertinent to the things that we find most interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense that, you know, the problems at hand and the concerns, what would it be, 80 years ago or 70 years ago, maybe they aren't speaking as clearly as those that are written right now. That makes sense. So before we jump into Matt's book, tell us a little bit about the development of New Mormon History. There's this quote phrase
right
here called the New Mormon History.
Right, and I think it's important to give this background, especially as we start giving into what I think are the 10 books, history books, I'd love for everyone to read in Mormon history, because I have a bias and I have a certain way that I look at the historical field that could be quite quixotic if you don't share my own assumptions. So it's good to give a background on how I think the field developed, which makes more sense of the books I ended up picking.
And now, Dr. Park will treat us with a 10-minute lecture on the development of the New Mormon History. For those that are lecture averse, fast forward 10 minutes to where the conversation picks up again. For those who just want to hear about Matt Bowman's book, The Mormon People, fast forward 14 minutes to get to the point where we talk specifically about that book.
If you're interested in how the Mormon history craft developed, the book that I'd strongly recommend is a book called Mormon History that's written by Ron Walker, David Whitaker, and Jim Allen. It was published by University of Illinois Press about a decade and a half ago, and it's just a history of Mormon history. And the general outlines of that is for the first 120-some-odd years of the Mormon faith, most histories were written from a partisan standpoint. Either you're defending the faith or you're rejecting the faith. And so that's why, and that's what shaped how history was developed. And institutionally, a long time after that, it was shaped that way. It wasn't until Fawn Brody and Juanita Brooks and a few others during the 1940s who came along outside of academic institutions, outside the power structure of the LDS faith, and they came and used academic tools, even though neither of them had advanced degrees in history, that gave, I'm not going to say disinterested history, because I think disinterested is a myth, but at least history that did not fit general narratives. And that kind of sparked a new academic approach to history of the faith, which was then emboldened and accelerated by Leonard Arrington, who received his PhD in the 1950s, and then in the 1960s led a movement of academically trained historians who sought to bring their tools from the historical craft to their own faith tradition. This is in the 1960s, 1970s, where you see things like the founding of the Mormon History Association, the founding of periodicals like Dialogue, BYU Studies, and eventually Journal of Mormon History. It's when Leonard Arrington was briefly made the church historian and inaugurated what's called Camelot, this mythic period of great openness and academic advancement. And this is what introduced New Mormon History. Now, New Mormon History is basically revolves around several key features, if I were to give a spreadsheet. One, most especially, they aim to use professional methods to understand Mormon history. They mostly drew in their methods from the tools of the New Social History, which was an academic approach that was all the rage in the 1960s and 1970s. But even though they drew from the tools of social history, they're mostly concerned with issues of intellectual history. And by intellectual history, I mean the history of ideas, the history of theology. So when we talked about New Mormon History, we're mostly talking about how people thought. Because that's what New Mormon History focused on. The practitioners of New Mormon History were mostly middle-class white males located in Utah institutions, whether the University of Utah, Brigham Young University, or the LDS Church. There were, of course, notable exceptions to that, but in general, it was mostly white males talking about white males. It was written, and while it was written at the quality of the academy using academic tools, it was mostly written for a Mormon audience, addressing Mormon questions. There was a rise of different venues that the New Mormon History work that's taking place in the 1970s and 1980s was finding an outlet. For the first time, university presses were publishing Mormon work. The University of Illinois Press became probably the flagship institution that published the best work in New Mormon History, although there are lots of independent publishers that were benefiting from this work. Presses like Signature Books, which was birthed during this period, probably reached its heyday for a lot of the great work they published, as well as Deseret Book during this period published works that's probably not recognizable for us who are used to the Deseret Book of 20-aughts. The best work of New Mormon History was usually presented at venues like the Mormon History Association or the John Whitmer Historical Association and was published mostly in Mormon-themed journals like Dialogue, BYU Studies, or Journal of Mormon History. If you were to see a primary divergence or battleground of this New Mormon History field, it was usually divided, if I'm doing simplistic, of course it's much more multifaceted than this, but the simplistic division would be between faithful and revisionists, the traditionalists, and those who are fighting those traditions. John Charles Duffy, who's a scholar who received his PhD at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill recently, wrote a master's thesis, a brilliant master's thesis that actually broke it up into four fields, but that's the general, the faithful and the revisionists. Benefits of New Mormon History was it professionalized Mormon history in general, and it also had the potential to make real change in the Mormon history community or in the Mormon community because it was addressed to Mormons, it spoke to Mormon concerns, and it was written in a way that the average Mormon might find it interesting. Now, whether the average Mormon even knew this existed is another matter. The downsides of this New Mormon History approach was that because it remained Mormon centric, it never received much of the attention of the broader academy. And it mostly was a replication of the Mormon questions and interests at stake within the Utah territory. And it failed to transcend the white male history that dominates most amateurish type of history. It also led to lots of infighting as a result. The battle over the Book of Mormon Wars or the Mormon History Wars that held lots of cultural relevance. Now, this then gave rise in the embers of these flame wars of the New Mormon History, which kind of faded out in the 1990s or so, saw the birth of Mormon studies. Now, I am defining Mormon studies as a different circle in the Venn diagram that somewhat overlaps with the Mormon history community, but is not concomitant to it. By Mormon studies, I mean those who are academically trained, who are writing about Mormonism for the broader academy. It is built on the shoulders of New Mormon history and draws from a lot of the same topics and sources as New Mormon history, but does it for new ends and through new methods. The key features that I would use to define Mormon studies means mostly is they have a diversity of approaches. Different disciplines are being brought into play, especially from the religious studies field, which becomes probably the primary battleground or field for this Mormon studies as opposed to Mormon history in general. They use Mormonism as a case study to address larger issues instead of studying Mormonism for Mormonism's sake. That is, Mormons are being studied as objects rather than subjects. Mormon studies generally focus on a diverse, or Mormon studies is practiced by a more diverse set of practitioners, both in terms of demographics, people of more ethnic background than just white Utah Mormons, belief, lots more non-Mormons take part in Mormon studies and in the New Mormon history, as well as institutions. Practitioners of Mormon studies are found at various universities throughout America and starting to be the globe. They also examined a broader range of subjects, including most especially women and minorities, as well as topics, whether it be ritual, lived religion, or theoretical approaches in general. It's not just a focus on Mormon thought anymore. The locus of Mormon studies is not at the Mormon History Association or in Mormon studies, Mormon history journals, but rather at national conferences like the American Historical Association, the American Academy of Religion, and in non-Mormon themed journals, the Journal of American History, or a Journal of the Early Republic, or journals that have a much broader audience. Most of the work of Mormon studies is published at university presses like Oxford University Press, which has carved its own niche of the field, but other presses, Yale, Harvard, North Carolina especially, are drawing it. And the primary divergence of New Mormon history was between faithful and revisionist. The primary divergence of Mormon studies is growing to be academic and amateur. Those who are working in the academic for an academic audience through academic presses, and those who are using the tools of academy, but mostly writing it from a much more generalist approach for a much more general audience. Now, the benefits of this new Mormon studies approach is it's more sophisticated approach, universal in application in terms of who they study, and it's much more broadly accepted, adopted, and acknowledged by the academy. The downside, though, of all this movement is much of the best work in Mormon studies is mostly relevant to other scholars and not as relevant to the average Mormon. Therefore, it doesn't have as much cultural capital as some of the great works of New Mormon history did, which mostly means that historians will have to then translate their findings for a general public through other methods, which would be a topic of another day. And of course, another downside of Mormon studies, just like New Mormon history and all Mormon scholarship in general, is it's still very American centric, which I don't know when or how that's going to change. Now, is anyone still awake after I give all of that?
I'm still awake. That's a nice 10-minute lecture on Mormon history, Mormon studies. So do you think, just real quick, a question on the Mormon studies, do you see that expanding beyond being U.S.-centric? And do you see a greater diversity of authors or investigators in terms of race, sex, all that?
Gosh, I hope so. Looking at general trends, I mean, we're starting to see more of an interest. I mean, there's two authors that are currently putting together an edited collection for Oxford University Press that's Decolonizing Mormonism, that looks at different ways to look at Mormon history that transcends the American focus. And so it'll be really exciting to see what comes out of that project. I think globalizing Mormon history or Mormon studies is something that everyone acknowledges has to happen, but not anyone has really dug into it yet. I mean, there's always been a few that do great work in international history and are arguing, hey, come join us, it's fun. But a lot of us are just stubborn and we resist. I think mostly because in Mormon studies, you get people who aren't specialist in Mormonism. You have people who are specialists in American resistance efforts or American religious practice or American religious politics who are interested in Mormonism and therefore bring Mormonism to their analysis. We have yet to find the people who are interested in South American history or South American religious history who are ready to incorporate Mormonism into their practice. I'm hoping that'll happen. There's a few people that do it, and I shouldn't say it's as bleak as I'm making it sound, because there are people doing great work. It's just still on the margins of the field, and I hope that changes at some point in the future.
Yeah, and I don't think there's a switch you can flip that'll just change the course of Mormon studies. It just kind of has to happen.
Right. I think the way that it can't go is that in the 1980s and 1990s, there's this big push that we need international Mormon history. And so we sent a lot of people decided they're going to do international Mormon history. And what they ended up doing was studying white missionaries in the Philippines or white missionaries to Asia or white missionaries to Eastern Europe or white missionaries to Africa. You should be getting the picture of what I'm saying here. This is what happens when you get people who are specialized in American Mormon history and tell them, hey, go do international history. What they're going to end up doing is doing international history that's only relevant to Americans.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a bit of a problem because Mormonism is really interesting, and it's one of the larger new religious movements, but it's still a minority.
Yeah.
It's a minority in the United States. It's an even smaller minority in Europe or in South America or in right. Southeast Asia or Africa. It's there. It definitely has a presence of some sort. But I think it's part of the problem is having a population of people that are interested into it. There's just other things in the world that are interesting, I guess.
Absolutely. Mormonism has proved to be a cultural power in America, and that's what draws scholarly attention. Until we prove Mormonism to have a cultural power or a relevance in other regions, for that region's sake, we're going to flounder in trying to get international history.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, so our first book is The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith by Matthew Bowman. And it's a survey of Mormon history. It starts from the beginning. It starts with Joseph Smith, and it ends in, is it 2010 or 2012?
It's written in 2012, so let's see what the last chapter goes to. I mean, it mostly, after 2000...
It talks about Romney in there on the last chapter. So.
After 2000, it mostly kind of blends together.
2011 is the date that he has there.
Yeah, and looks like the last paragraph of the book focuses on 2010. So 2010, 2011, around there is when he ends it.
Yep. Yeah, so before we get into this, what other survey texts, what other broad sweeping history of Mormonism were in place before Bowman wrote this work?
Right. So there's always been attempts to write a broad sweeping history of the church, even going back all the way to Joseph Smith. He dictates the scribes to keep a history of the church, which of course was not written by scholarly standards by our day or their day's means. But during this period of where you're either pro-Mormon or anti-Mormon, there are several of these histories. Most notably is probably B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History of the Church that he writes in the early 20th century. That is pretty impressive in what he did as an amateur and only having access to certain histories and written for certain audiences. The field basically changed during the 1970s when Leonard Arrington is leading this Camelot period in the Church History Library where they're trying to produce history for both the LD, for both members and for the broader public. Leonard Arrington, who's church historian at the time, assigns himself and Davis Bitten, who is an assistant church historian, to write a general survey of the church for the general public. That resulted in The Mormon Experience, A History of Latter-day Saints, which was published by Knopf in 1979. It's a very useful one volume history of the church, and it's and to look at it, it's pretty surprising how frank they as church employees were on a lot of controversial issues. It was surprisingly frank in discussing things like the translation of the Book of Mormon, of the First Vision, of Joseph Smith's varying accounts of the First Vision. It included a chapter on women in the Mormon faith, which is quite revolutionary for its period. The downsides was it was pretty weak on the 20th century. And in general, it was not as cutting edge for its period as you would have expected for someone like Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitten to be in charge, probably because they relied on research assistants for a lot of that writing. That volume is now in a second edition paperback version published by Illinois University Press in 1992. Yeah, so if you are a Mormon collector, that's a wonderful book to have. So while Leonard Arrington assigned himself to write that book, he assigned his other assistant church historian, Jim Allen, as well as a church history department staff member, Glenn Leonard, to write a one-volume overview of the saints for Mormons, and that came out as The Story of the Latter-day Saints, published in 1976 by Deseret Book. What's remarkable is even though that book is written for a Latter-day Saint audience, it is probably, taking a step back and looking at it, a bit more professionally responsible than Arrington and Bitten's volume, and is probably the better one-volume overview of Mormonism produced in the 1970s. It has better prose, it draws from better sources, and more importantly, it's much stronger on the 20th century than Arrington and Bitten. But just like Arrington and Bitten, it's mostly focused on white leaders of the faith, doesn't have a look to global, and it doesn't have the focus on women that Arrington and Bitten did. Several other helpful overviews published in the last couple decades. Terrell Givens wrote an overview called The Latter-day Saint Experience in America for Greenwood Press in 2004. That was written specifically to be used in the classroom. I do not know if it has been used in a classroom, but I imagine it could properly be done so. Two very short ones, Richard and Claudia Bushman, the husband and wife tandem, wrote Building the Kingdom, A History of Mormonism in America, published by Oxford University Press in 1999. Very small paperback volume, very good in approach. And then Richard Bushman, just a few years ago, wrote Mormonism, A Very Short Introduction, also by Oxford University Press. Only has half of the book focused on history, the other half on culture and theology and things, but also a good overview. Those are the other general overviews on the market before Bowman's book came into existence.
Perfect. Well, that leads us right into why, I mean, you've got within the last, I guess, the decade or so preceding Bowman, you've got three decent books that talk about Mormon history as an overview. So why is it that, why was The Mormon People written?
Well, The Mormon People was very firmly grounded in Mitt Romney's 2012 run for the presidency during the height of what was most recently dubbed the Mormon moment, although we all know that that was just the most recent to many Mormon moments. But during Romney's run, Mormonism is in the spotlight, and Random House, which is one of the major trade publishing houses in America, decides they need a book on Mormonism. And what are we going to do? They approach Richard Bushman first, and Richard Bushman declines. He's already written several books on that are overview. But he recommended Matt Bowman, who is this young, recently PhD recipient from Georgetown University. But he was a perfect guy for the project because, A, he's probably the smartest scholar of the rising generation of Mormon scholars. He's just absolutely brilliant. And second, he writes at a pace that probably laps anyone else in the field. In fact, he's able to produce this book, The Mormon People, in such a quick time that it blows to shreds all the apologetic arguments that since the Book of Mormon was only written in 60 days, it has to be divine. Well, Matt Bowman wrote this book nearly in about that same timetable, and it's pretty
so impressive. It's divine, then.
It's divine. You could say it is a divinely appointed book.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. So who was it that was approaching him that wanted the book? I didn't quite...
Random House is the publisher. It was
so they just noticed that Mormons were getting talked about all the time and they wanted a book on Mormonism.
Right. They know it would sell. They knew they wanted to make money off of the Mormon moment. but they wanted it responsibly done. The guy who was the head of Random House approached it, John Meacham, who's a pretty noted historian who's run a Pulitzer Prize for in his own right for writing history. And so they didn't want something choppy or shoddy. They wanted something quality, but they wanted it quick. And Matt Bowman ended up being the perfect guy to do it. So that's one thing to keep in mind when you approach this book, that it is near miraculous that the book exists in itself and the time constraints that was given for it to be written.
So they didn't approach John Krakauer?
They did not approach John Krakauer, sadly.
Okay.
I'm sure it probably would have sold a lot better, but in the end it would have been a net negative.
Oh, that's interesting how this came about. I had heard little bits of that.
I was fortunate to be one of the ones who was looking over drafts as Matt was writing it. And
I
could say that he was writing the chapters at a quicker pace than I could edit them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Yeah, and it's not short on endnotes and on references and source material. It's pretty thorough. I mean, I'm amazed that a book, I mean, let me just check real quick. The appendices in this book also are very useful.
Right.
Like you read the main body of the book, but then the appendices give you a sneak peek into some of the New Mormon history and things that we had already talked about. But the main text is 250 pages or so.
It's pretty hefty.
And it's a decent sized book, but he really covers the Mormon story quite well in that short period of time. And if you compare that to B.H. Roberts' History of the Church, Comprehensive History of the Church, it's a lot smaller. So
right. If you one thing on the appendices before we get in the bulk of the things, the bibliographic essay found at the end of the book, that is worth the price of the purchase of the book in itself. If you want an overview on the historiography of the church in the last 40 years, this bibliographic essay is one of the best ways to do it. That also has an article published in the History Compass on Mormonism and its historians. It's kind of an extension of this, but it's this is a great place to go. Oh, is there a book on such and such topic? Just turn to the bibliographic essay in the back of the book and you will find out.
And you'll get 5 to 10 books.
That's right.
On any given period, it looks like. Yeah. Yeah. The appendices there are really great. I think very useful. Like for instance, he talks about the cast of characters, and you hear these names dropped as you read blogs, as you read books, or listen to podcasts, or just hear people talk. But he gives you a little bit of a little biography on each person that had some significant impact in the history of Mormonism.
Right.
So a lot of useful stuff in the back end there. So let's get into the general argument, the general idea of the book.
Right. It's fine. In some ways, the book is oddly broken up in chapters, which can easily be explained by the circumstances in which they're written. Because a general argument, as shown in the title of the book, he's wanting to focus on the Mormon people. He didn't want to write a history of the church institution. He didn't want to write a history of the primary leaders of the faith. He really wanted to get into the Mormon people. Now, the downside, you say that, and then you look at the book and you realize there's 3 chapters dedicated to Joseph Smith's life, which is a bit quixotic after just saying that he wants to focus on the Mormon people and not specific leaders. That's, I mean, A, because if you want to sell a book of Mormonism, you have to have quite a bit of Joseph Smith stuff. And 2, there's just so much stuff in the early period that you try to cover that there ends up being a lot of focus. But in general, it's broken up in the general sections that we're used to in Mormon history, which is the Joseph Smith period, the territorial Utah period, which gets 2 chapters in this book, one on Utah in general and one on polygamy, because you can't sell a trade press without one chapter dedicated to sex.
That's right.
You have one chapter dedicated to the transition period, which he titles the Eternal Progression, one chapter on the David O. McKay era, basically, which he defines on correlation, which is significant, and we'll get into that in a moment. And then finally, a brief final chapter that's looking toward a global church, which is much more provocative than substantial in its approach because of the source material. and the writing. But because of the nature of the project, Matt states pretty clearly in the introduction that this is a project of synthesis. He is not plowing new grounds in primary research in this work, A, because the circumstances in which he was writing wouldn't allow it, and two, because of the nature of a one-volume overview, you can't get too much into particulars. So what he frames this book to be is an attempt to capture all the insights from the last generation of scholarship. So you're not going to find a lot of digging into primary sources or the archives as much as this summarizing the primary arguments of other books, which is pretty significant for those who, the listeners who are like, I don't want to have to plow through even 10 books. I just want a general overview. This is the type of book you have to go to.
Yeah, this book is definitely the place to start. I mean, I started reading Rough Stone Rolling, and then I came across this one, and it was just so fascinating to get this broad sweeping overview. It hits on all the issues that come up, you know, over and over again in the blogosphere, and you know, it just gives you a good background. And the other interesting thing for me that I found was for someone new to reading history of the church that's not by the church is that he was using neutral language.
Right.
Like he was saying, this is what the Mormons believe, rather
right.
than saying, this is what ultimate reality is,
right.
you know, from a Mormon perspective, for instance. And several people that I've talked to noticed that as well, that where this was their first book reading Mormon history, it was a good way to ease into taking a little bit of a dispassionate approach to the canonized history of our faith.
Exactly, exactly. It's a good introduction to the historical craft just as much as Mormon history in general.
Yeah.
Good. All right, so since we don't have that much time to focus on, I'm going to jump forward, quickly jump across the first five chapters. Noting that the first three chapters on Joseph Smith, a good overview on Joseph Smith and his period, but it's also really good, even though it's framed around Joseph Smith's life, it really does a good job on separating Joseph Smith from the church and talking about what the Mormons would have believed during Joseph Smith's day, what kind of cultures Joseph Smith's followers would have come from, what they would have found in Joseph Smith's message, rather than focusing just on Joseph Smith's message itself. So there's a subtle but important difference going on. The two chapters on Utah, chapter 4, Come Ye Saints, 1846 to 1877, is a good overview on what life was like in territorial Utah during the period. He does a great job in bringing in sociological factors, economic factors, domestic factors, political factors, covers Mountain Meadows Massacre quite well as Brigham Young's presidency. And then he saves all the juicy plural marriage stuff for chapter 5. And chapter 5, if you want to go and find just a brief overview of scholarship on polygamy, especially during the Utah years, chapter 5 of this book is a great place to go, because he relies a lot on the statistical data and demographical data that comes from Catherine Dane's books, which we'll talk about later on in the year, as well as brings in the rhetorical points that are brought out by historians like Carmen Hardy, as well as the lived conditions of a lot of the plural wives. And so this is a history as much of plural wives and the women who are living polygamy as much as it is about the doctrine that undergirded the practice. Now let's throw the rest of the 19th century out the window, because there's a lot of books that cover that, and we'll cover that in future podcasts. But what I think is a real gem of this book is that it basically rewrites or writes for the first time a general narrative of 20th century Mormon history. Because this was the period in which Mormon history surveys previous to this point had been rather weak. If you take any look at a list of Mormon history books, one of the first things that'll jump out at you is that it's very focused on the 19th century. Everyone wants to study Joseph Smith. Everyone wants to study Brigham Young. Everyone wants to study polygamy. And so there's not as much research done on the 20th century for a lot of other reasons that we'll get into in future podcasts. So what Matt Bowman is trying to do is he almost has to invent the wheel here. And he does it in very provocative and interesting ways. So when he's talking about the transition period, the period generally described between 1890 and 1920, what he does is, no, we're not just going to focus on the transition from polygamy to monogamy, which has been the major focus. We're going to focus on how Mormons picked up cultural elements of progressive era America. How believing in institutions, being able to reform the people, believing in correlative materials in order to bring everyone together. He says that is the founding principle of what happens to Mormonism following the decline of polygamy. And so his chapter 6, Eternal Progression, is not only a good overview of the secondary material, but actually quite a novel reinterpretation of this period of Mormon history. He puts a lot of, provocatively, he puts a lot of emphasis on women's roles, especially the leaders of the Relief Society during this period, in shaping how church practice is built. In fact, he said, I can't remember if he says it in this book specifically or somewhere else, but he says that after this period, most of us live in the church that Amy Brown Lyman built. Putting an emphasis on how people like Amy Brown Lyman really changed how the church is structured, which leaked out into the lived reality of Mormonism. The next chapter on correlation is a pretty brilliant look on the rise of correlation culture, or the centralization of authority and outputs of the church within a common structure found at 50 East North Temple Street in Salt Lake City. This is one area of the book that he actually does draw on primary research, because this is a topic of a project he's working on now, which is the rise of correlation of the church. And he looks at the idea of correlation as not just a structural or institutional necessity, which it very well is, but it was also a doctrinal framework that lots of people like David O. McKay and the other architects of the Correlation Project actually believed in how a church is supposed to be organized. They believed that the correlation was going to introduce the millennium for Mormonism and finally initiate the new realm of Mormon history. And this is actually, broadly speaking, a much more cultural movement that found exposure in Catholicism and Judaism during the same period. And then finally, his last chapter, Toward a Global Church, is much more provocative than substantive because of the nature of the chapter. It's very recent, as well as the paucity of sources and secondary work. So what he's basically doing is hinting at ways that the church has developed during the last few decades and ways it may go in the future. He's at his best when he's talking about Hinckley's move toward placing more emphasis on public relations and becoming good neighbors, as well as the focus on more global initiatives of the church and not really seeing the church primarily as an American institution.
Yeah, I'm real quick on the correlation chapter. That was really, I think it's really useful, because often correlation in discussions online is like anything that we don't like about the church right now, it's due to correlation.
Right.
It's like that's the blame. And it's like this malevolent force came and made correlation happen just to ruin roadshows and other things that you that used to happen in the church. Exactly. That made it more interesting. And it's useful, and I think it's good to see some of the motivation behind the correlation movement and what their goal was.
As a fun background, I was chatting with Steve Shields, who is known for his work on break-off Mormon schisms throughout the last couple centuries, and he's a Community of Christ figure, the formerly Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's in their administration. And he's actually, he was telling me at the John Whitmer Historical Association meeting a few months ago that the Communion of Christ is now at the point that the LDS Church was in the 1940s and 50s, trying to set up a correlation thing that's necessary for a global church. And he said that he went through Matt Bowman's book, that chapter on correlation, as a blueprint for what the Communion of Christ is supposed to do now.
Oh, interesting. That's kind of neat. Yeah, I've heard that each congregation has, in the Community of Christ, they kind of self-determine their whatever they're going to study that year, or what, rather than, you know, we've known all my life that every 4 years you go through the standard works, and, you know, things are changing very slightly now, I think, with the youth curriculum, and maybe things will change in the past, but for the longest time it's been very organized. And, you know, you often hear that praise when you go to another ward. You know, the church is true wherever you go, because it's the same, whether, you know, you're around the world where I serve my mission in Cambodia, or you're in Utah, you're learning the same lesson. That's interesting that they're I wonder how that will shape out in the next couple years, or next decade or so for them.
I mean, they have to learn to what extent they're going to use it, how much of the positive, because, I mean, we certainly know that there are downsides of correlation. Yeah. There are some things that we wish we could change, but I think overall, when you look on the history, that there's actually a lot of good things, and probably more than saying good things, that there's a lot of necessity that comes with something like a correlation structure.
Yeah, especially with the size of the church. And one of the things that I often think is, you look at the madness of the 19th century church, and I think, I don't want that.
Right.
You know, there was some crazy stuff going on back then that, you know, I'm glad that we are much more assimilated, and, you know, that there's some good things that have come from being standardized and correlated.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the last chapter was interesting because everything was familiar, because it's stuff that's happened in the news in the last decade or so.
Jimmer Fredette, the Mormon musical.
President Hinckley, you know, he was the first president to go in into the public media in a large way.
Right.
And, you know, I remember being so proud of President Hinckley as around my mission age, because that's when he went on Larry King Live and like, look how brave he is. You know, he's a brave, wonderful Mormon, not afraid of anything. So it's just neat to see that stuff that's still in the back of our minds, treated in somewhat of an analytical way as a church movement. So,
I think, you know, one of the reasons why Random House trusted Matt with this project is because he wrote a fabulous op-ed that was in the New Republic the previous year, that talked about Mitt Romney, John Huntsman's, and the two different Mormon genealogies they represented. And in that piece, he argued about basically the change in Mormon culture that happened between the President Kimball, President Benson type of period, and the President Hinckley. And he's saying that Mitt Romney was very much the former type of period, and John Huntsman was very much the latter and the future of the Mormon identity. And it was very provocative, very smart, and it very much frames the type of approach he talks about of the transition taking place during that last chapter.
Well, this has been a great discussion on the Mormon people and the mini lecture we got on New Mormon history and how we got to the state that we're in now.
I promise I won't be as preachy in future podcasts.
Well, yeah, we've got that established. Now we can talk more about the books, and some of the Rough Stone Rolling is a much more substantial book, just as far as the volume of content.
Right.
So it'll take a little bit more time just going through Rough Stone Rolling and its predecessors and what have you. But like you said early on, I just want to reiterate, if 10 books is still too much, but you want to be informed on Mormon history, read The Mormon People by Matt Bowman. And if you want a little bit more than that, Brian Whitney has made a website called MormonismInContext.com, and he's designed it as this course, like what you would expect at a college course about Mormonism 101, and The Mormon People is his textbook, and he also links to all the recent church essays on interesting or controversial parts of Mormon history, and he uses the Mormons PBS documentary that came out in 2007 as another way to talk about the arc of history. And so this book fits in really well with that. If you're reading the essays and you want more context, this will give it to you. If you remember the PBS documentary, this is very complimentary with that work. So this is your one-stop shop if you're not too hungry to read a whole bunch of books.
Exactly.
So anyway, thanks for coming on, Ben. Next time we get together, we'll talk about Rough Stone Rolling.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ben.
No, my pleasure.
So, Brian, is The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith, is that one of the books that you have checked off your to-read list?
Yes. Well, I mean, a confession that I have, maybe I shouldn't admit this, but I'm really big into – I'm super busy, and when I do have time to read actual books –
You're way busy.
Yeah, so yeah, I am.
You're the busiest person I know.
It's
giving you a hard time.
It's terrible. It's terrible. I'm sorry, but when I do have time to read, I'm reading more like technical research articles and differing things that I can't. So I listen to tons of audiobooks and stuff, and The Mormon People is one that happens to be available in audiobook form, which a lot of these books aren't. So if you like audiobooks, then this is one that it is available. And I loved it. Like a lot of the stories that are told in it are stories that we hear all of the time, stories that we hear talks about and stuff I talked about a lot on my mission. So it's kind of a very, like, as far as the stories go, they are things that you'll be familiar with, you know, that if you have been kind of invested within the church and things, but it goes into these stories in a much deeper way, in a way that you're like, wow, this is what was going on at that time period during this story. Like, I loved it. I thought it was really interesting to kind of hear those same things that I thought I was really familiar with, but hear some of the details that I had been missing.
Yeah, I felt the same way. It provides context. A lot of the stories that you've heard, given either from a family home evening or from learning in church, they're never really told in context, like in the wider history of the United States. They're told in isolation of, like, the church was doing this, and then, you know, the federal government was doing this. It doesn't give you the big overarching picture, and this book does that for you. And it also, it doesn't skirt any of the controversial issues either, I don't think. So it was a great book. I loved it. And the next one that we're going to talk about in this series is Rough Stone Rolling. So that one might be, that interview might be as long as this one, just because that's such a big book, both in influence and in volume.
Yeah.
And so look forward to that one.
I think that's the one where most, when people think of good historical works on Mormonism, I think a lot of people will think of that book, one of the first ones. So that'll be a fun one to talk about.
Yeah. Yep. It'll be good. For the next episode, you can look forward to us talking about sex again with Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. That's been a very popular series that we've had going on the podcast so far, and you'll get another dose of that, another dose of sex next week. So, Mormons, rational faithers, keep keeping it weird.